This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Stop and go. That is just the way this recovery is going to be, and we ought just get used to it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kyle Risdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 18th day of May. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. So look, there are going to be some hiccups in this economy as it comes out of the pandemic. The jobs report a couple of weeks ago was one. We were talking a million jobs. Remember that? We got 266,000. And those hiccups can hit even sectors that have been humming right along. We've been talking for a while now about housing and its boom. Low interest rates, pandemic-motivated moves, limited supply and rising prices. And yet today, we learned new construction, housing starts is the technical term, were off more than 9% last month. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports to get us going, there are a couple of reasons why builders have been holding back.
Securing the parts that go into building a home has been tricky recently, thanks largely to the volatile price of lumber.
Well, I call it a hysterical market at this point.
Brian Leonard is a lumber analyst at RCM Alternatives. He says prices have been rising throughout the pandemic, causing many builders to hold off on buying wood. But last month, many realized they couldn't wait any longer. Lumber prices spiked even more, and now supplies are thin.
The full-blown building season is basically, you know, April through August. And all of a sudden, these guys don't have the wood to start supplying some of these jobs.
Something else in short supply? Labor, says Brian Termail with the Associated General Contractors of America. He says some construction workers worry about getting COVID on the job site. They also might be receiving expanded unemployment insurance. They might have found work in other industries.
Our members are going to be competing with energy sector. They're going to be competing with the mining sector.
Several other ingredients that go into building a new home have been stuck in the supply chain, given the ongoing congestion at U.S. ports. Mike Fratantoni is chief economist at the Mortgage Bankers Association.
Many builders having difficulty finding appliances to put into new homes, and the new owners having to go out and buy those appliances.
There are signs that housing construction could pick up again. For instance, building permits fell at a much slower rate than the drop in housing starts. Fratantoni says that's a sign that home builders think building supplies and prices could start to stabilize.
That's going to result in a lower overall price sometime down the road.
And even though some construction projects are stalling, he says demand for new homes is still strong. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
President Biden was in Dearborn, Michigan today, took a tour of the factory where Ford's building the electric version of the best-selling car or truck in America, the F-150 pickup. Took a little spin in it, too, the president did. This is a quote, "Suckers quick," he apparently said as he zipped past reporters. Which is all well and good. You like to see the president having a good time. But EVs are just one way of cutting carbon emissions, both here and globally. The International Energy Agency released a report today listing all the things we will have to change to get to zero carbon emissions by 2050, which is the goal in the Paris Climate Accords. The agency says that by 2030, 8.5 short years from right now, 60% of cars sold worldwide, 60%, are going to have to be electric if we are going to get to where we need to be. Right now, by the way, 5% is where EVs are. And that is far from the only thing that is going to have to happen, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Getting to net zero carbon emissions by 2050 is going to require a lot of change really quickly.
We don't have a day to lose.
Rachel Kite is dean of the Fletcher School of International Affairs at Tufts University. She says one of the most significant steps the IEA says the world needs to take basically immediately.
No more oil and gas exploration. No new unabated coal plants should be approved for development. And that should be right now, this year. No ifs, buts, or whys.
The IEA also says countries need to phase out existing coal plants.
And that we will be relying much more quickly and much more completely on modern renewable energy.
Primarily wind and solar. That's starting to happen already, says Steve Nadell at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
Wind and solar will often be the cheapest new source of electricity today. A lot of the new construction is starting to go in that direction.
But Nadell says one of the challenges with relying more on renewable energy has always been finding ways to store it to use later.
Think of a early morning during the middle of a cold wave and the wind is calm and the sun's not shining. That's when we need that storage.
A lot of the technology we need to start down the path the IEA has laid out to net zero carbon emissions already exists. But Jason Bordoff at the Columbia Climate School says there are still problems we have yet to figure out how to solve.
If you're going to think about the things that are harder to decarbonize, like airplanes and big ships and steel and cement, we don't have all of those tools at commercial scale yet.
Which means, Bordoff says, companies and governments need to invest a lot more in developing new technology. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
One more electric vehicle tidbit before we go on, just because Lamborghini announced today it's going to roll out a plug-in hybrid by 2023. Lambos are going to be all electric by 2030. I do kind of wonder what they're going to sound like, though, right? Remember all the chit-chat about retail sales last week? The companies making all those sales have started reporting profits. Good would be a word you might use. Elsewhere in market-based capitalism today, traders on Wall Street, they were kind of a downer. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a new survey out on household financial well-being from the Federal Reserve. It's another validation of that K-shaped recovery we have been talking about. Some people doing all right or even doing well, and the lower parts of the income spectrum still really suffering. Those disparities have increased along racial and gender lines, but perhaps the most dramatic split is the one between more and less educated workers. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the value of a college degree in the post-pandemic economy.
At the top of the K are people with a college degree. In 2020, almost 90% of them who took the Fed survey indicated they were doing at least okay financially, more than before the pandemic. But the opposite was true for folks without a high school degree, and the gap between these groups has widened by 10 percentage points since 2019.
What you have is a bit more stability at the upper end, BA and above, and a lot more instability below.
Mike Horrigan is president of the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says about three quarters of the job losses during the pandemic, like in retail and tourism, were among people without a BA. Inequities had already been growing over recent decades, says Anthony Carnevale at Georgetown's Center on Education and the Workforce.
The harsh reality now is that you got to have at least some college to get a decent job.
But he says simply telling people to go to college is not the answer.
The education system is reproducing race and class advantages across generations. And that's a a very serious problem going forward.
People with the most privilege continue to have the greatest access to higher education. Colleges need students who can afford to pay more. And those already well-off students often reap a greater benefit from the degree, says Catherine Zekier at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
We know that pursuing a college degree is a large financial risk for the individual. So, for instance, Black college graduates owe more student debt at graduation. And we also know they might not pay off.
That's because the more you borrow to go to college, the more it eats into those increased wages if you graduate. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Hey, so you want to find out what's going on in business and economic news early of a weekday morning? Well, just turn on David. David Brancaccio on the Marketplace Morning Report. They'll tell you what you need to know. We've known for a while now that bias is a problem in this economy. Tainted decision-making driven by preconceived notions. But it's also true that the judgments we make, from hiring decisions to corporate strategy and more, differ from person to person or even in the same person on different days. Something as simple as the weather outside or the results of a recent football game can affect the decisions that people make. It's called noise. It is also the title of a new book from Nobel Prize-winning psychologist and behavioral economics pioneer Daniel Kahneman. I spoke to him the other day about what inspired the book.
I became interested in noise in the context of consulting, a large insurance company. Now, I asked the executives of the company a question that I would invite all your listeners to ask themselves as well. Suppose you take two underwriters. By how much do you expect them to differ in the premiums that they set? Now, clearly, it's a matter of judgment, so you don't expect them to agree perfectly. By what percentage do you expect them to differ? Turns out the executives of the company had a number, and that number is the same number that probably occurred to you and occurred to most listeners. It's 10%.
That's so funny. That's literally what I was going to say. I was going to jump in. Absolutely. Yes, 10%.
I knew that because we've asked hundreds of people that question. That's what people think. 10% is sort of tolerable.
Yeah.
Now, when we actually measured it, the actual difference between two randomly chosen underwriters was 55%.
Huh.
So more than five times as much as people had expected. And it's that conjunction of there existing a major problem of variability in judgment and of the organization not even being aware that there is a problem. This is what motivated the writing of this book ultimately.
There's a question that occurs to me, and I don't know how to say it other than to point out that you are looking for, you know, you rightly point out that these variations in judgment in a courtroom are completely unacceptable, and I understand that. But I wonder if you are tilting at a windmill here, looking for a noiseless society economy, when that can't really be, because what you have in this society doing all the deciding are people, and we are inherently noisy.
Well, how noisy is really the question. When an organization has employees in the same role who are really expected to be interchangeable, underwriters within a unit are supposed to be interchangeable, patent officers, they're supposed to be interchangeable. That is, when you're interacting with the company, with the organization, you don't want to face a lottery where the number that the organization sets you depends on who happened to be on your case. So there are quite a few things that can be done to reduce noise. You want to give them guidelines, a checklist, give them a framework for comparing cases to each other. We call those steps decision hygiene. Basically, it's a kind of discipline to make them less noisy and incidentally also less biased.
Are you a sports fan at all, Professor Kahneman?
Not really.
No. I was going to ask you a question about instant replay and judgment and how that
clearly,
how it takes the human element out a little bit.
Well, it's not instant replay is supposed to take the human element out completely. And it's very clear that the reason that people instituted instant replay, that there was a lot of noise. A different referee looking at it from a slightly different angle might very well make a different call.
Danny Kahneman, his latest book is called Noise, A Flaw in Human Judgment. It's I'll tell you, Professor, it's a little tough to wrap your brain around this one, you know?
That is actually a very important observation. Bias is easy to think about.
Yeah.
So a woman was not hired who should have been hired in a place where you suspect that there might be bias against women, you can detect that. Wrapping your mind about sets of cases and statistical stories is way harder.
Yeah.
And noise belongs to the latter.
Danny, thanks very much. I appreciate your time, sir.
Very good. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a nice afternoon.
Bye-bye.
He insisted I call him Danny, by the way, so don't at me, all right? Coming up.
And I thought, just for fun, I have some time.
Oh, what could possibly go wrong? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 267 points today, 0.7%, closed at 34,060. The NASDAQ down 75 points, about 0.5%, 0.5% is another way to say that. 13,303. The S&P 500 down 35 points, 0.8%, 41.27. As we heard from Sam Fields, getting to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, we're going to have to get some wind, solar, and renewables in there. Brookfield Renewable up 2.6% today. First Solar rose 1.1%. I teased out retailers a little bit. Walmart ticked up 2.1% today. Macy's dipped 0.3% even after BofA earnings. Home Depot, same, lost 1%. Bonds fell only a little bit, though. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note flat at 1.64%. You're listening to Marketplace. It's listeners like you who make our journalism possible. And when you donate $7 a month, you can get our new Liquid Assets Mason Jar mug, along with some cocktail and mocktail recipes from my Marketplace colleagues. Beer, for me, and it goes well in any kind of container. Get yours by donating today at marketplace.org/donate. And cheers. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You remember back in the before times, there were these things called happy hours? You'd go after work, bond with your colleagues maybe, blow off a little steam in the process too, while bars and restaurants got your business. Those times are not quite these times just yet, because with lots of people still working from home and a lot of companies going full-on remote or some kind of hybrid, happy hours as we knew them have changed, both for workers and for the watering holes they used to frequent. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has our story.
I'm going to take you somewhere no Marketplace listener has gone before. Our New York office happy hour.
Hey!
How's it going?
What's up, homie?
I feel like I haven't seen your face in months.
We've been doing these virtual toasts on and off during the pandemic, and in some ways, they're better than the real thing. I get to see colleagues who work odd hours or usually have to rush to pick up their kids from school. I've met parents and partners and puppies. And sometimes, there's baby therapy.
He is 10 months.
Wow. Oh my gosh. He's so cute.
There are also the drawbacks. You know them well. The awkward pauses, the way everyone has to take turns talking, and how sipping a beer at the desk or dining table you've been sitting at for 8 hours doesn't always feel so happy. Here's Marketplace digital producer Alex Schroeder.
When I log back into Zoom, just the confines still sort of feel all in the same way they do during work.
Part of that is because for some people, happy hour, even in person, can seem like an extension of the workday. Jeffrey Pfeffer is a professor of organizational behavior at Stanford.
It feels contrived, that it feels like it's something that you're doing strategically. Social relationships matter. To the extent people know you, they are more likely to give you a higher evaluation.
A lot of what happens at the bar is genuine. Pfeffer says socializing is a key part of job satisfaction. But the spontaneity this kind of kinship requires has been lost during the pandemic. And it's not just workers feeling the effects. For many bars, happy hour has become a dead zone. And the deals, the discounted apps and drinks, they're mostly gone too. Michael Maxwell is with Blue Orbit, a hospitality consulting company.
I mean, if you look at what it's all about, it's a reduced price. That's the last thing we wanted to do during the pandemic is reduce prices. It's in crowded spaces and it's gathering after work. It's everything in the equation that didn't fit at all.
He says in normal times, a good happy hour at a 50-seat bar can boost daily sales by $1,000 or more. But even as restrictions relax, he thinks bars will keep discounts out of the equation to take advantage of the boom the industry is already seeing in spending. It'll be a while before that happens in business districts. Niall Moran at Rosie Dunn's, an Irish bar in Midtown Manhattan, says the office crowd used to make up 70% of his sales.
Basically thronged with people right now. They'd be just, and then, you know, the noise and the clattering of the glasses and the laughter and, you know, just the general merriment.
Instead, at 5 o'clock on a Wednesday, just a few customers nurse drinks at the big wooden bar. Still, Moran, who's been in the industry for 30 years, isn't looking to put a happy hour sign outside his bar anytime soon. He's worried rising food costs and wages mean it'll be harder to make a profit. Instead, he's redoing the menu to get people to stay for dinner.
You hear, oh my God, no one's ever going back to work again. I'm certainly betting on New York. I mean, I know it's coming back, you know.
And maybe he's right. A few minutes later, a group comes in wearing blouses and suit jackets. Turns out they used to be regulars.
Every day. I'm serious. I'm actually not kidding.
Megan McEnroe and her colleagues work in HR at a financial services firm nearby. Right now, coming into the office is optional, but Shadi Batar makes the commute a couple times a week.
And for me specifically, I come in just to see and socialize with my coworkers to break up the week. You know, I can do my job from home just as easily, but it's really for the socialization aspect.
Even if the deals don't return, some workers are committed to keeping 5 o'clock alive. In New York, I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
A lot of people have taken the opportunity this pandemic has presented to make some changes. Sometimes big ones, too, like careers. People finding themselves either dissatisfied with what they're doing now or forced to choose something new because the pandemic cost them their job. And some who are between gigs have taken that break as a chance to launch a side hustle, a passion project they've maybe been sitting on for a while. That is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Yobi Q. I am an entrepreneur in New York City. I own a few childcare centers that service families with children 2 to 6 years old. But in March, when the pandemic hit, the Department of Health gave us an order to shut down or close. I thought this won't hurt my business that much, but we ended up closing 2 of the locations. As an entrepreneur, as a hustler at heart, I had the time to kind of refocus my energy, try to figure out what's going to happen. Before the pandemic, I've already written and published 1 children's book. It's about how different Asian communities celebrate Lunar New Year. And I never thought about publishing children's books again. It was just something I did because I needed a book for my classroom. And I thought about maybe just writing 1 more children's book. Just for fun, I have some time. The books I published in the pandemic all focus on featuring Asian children, family, because the Asian community is extremely diverse. And for example, my Moon Festival book, I featured the Chinese community that celebrate the Moon Festival, the Vietnamese and the Japanese community. And we talked about the culture and the food and the meaning behind the holidays. I launched a Kickstarter. I was so scared. I'm like, oh, is this the best time to be an Asian entrepreneur woman in this field? And the support came in rates that I never really expected it. I was really shy. I asked for $5,000 and we had a 30-day campaign and we raised a little over $8,000. So we got a lot of support, which I'm really grateful for because the Asian community was under attack for the pandemic. I didn't know if that was a good time to launch a product like this, a children's book focused on Asian holidays. I was able to reach out to a few principals and school districts and work with them to promote multicultural resources such as my books, where we talked about the beauty of our culture and raise something positive in the Asian community. I will continue to write just because I love it. I am standing behind something much bigger than profits and myself, and something that will go on long after I'm not in the world anymore.
Yumi Q owns a couple of childcare centers. Also, she writes children's books in New York City. We can only tell your stories of this economy, you know, if you tell them to us. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today for the casual investors out there. Once again, please, please, please check your ticker symbols. This from the Wall Street Journal, which note that shares of the furniture retailer Ethan Allen, ticker symbol ETH, are up 51% year to date, up nearly 200% over the past year. Company's doing fine, right? But maybe not as fine as the cryptocurrency with which it shares that ETH ticker, Ether, which has quadrupled in price this year. Please, you got to pay attention. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. It goes in the closer to normal file. Data from OpenTable. They do restaurant reservations. And they had some data back last March and April that showed pretty starkly how we were all staying home before the stay-at-home orders came out. They've got some new data out today. It shows U.S. restaurant occupancy, I guess would be the word, between 90 and 100%. There are some caveats with this. It's only restaurants that are open for seated dinners, and most, if not all, are at reduced capacity. But like I said, closer to normal. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.